We welcome you to this session on grief in animals and people with Fritz Norstedt and Leo Bustin. And I told you why. With Fritz, you got to get in the first word. So I'm first. And the grief that I'll be talking about is the deep and violent sorrow that's manifest with a loss, with great loss. Fritz and I have like some of you, have lost real big. We lost daughters, remarkable daughters, before their life, the shadow of their life touched noon. So we lost not only a lot of the past, but a great amount of the future. But I'm going to talk a bit about that, my main emphasis is on the loss of animals and a grief manifest in animals and people losing animals and some of the things you can do to help in those circumstances. And I'm sure Fritz will also address this because he's also lost animals. Now, the reason I came to Holden 23 years ago is because Fritz was on the program. And our family came up here. Our son has never been here, but our two daughters, and Chief and I, had to drag them screaming and at me for bringing them up here. But after that, I had trouble keeping them away. But the reason I came up here now in my 55th trip or whatever it is, it's over 50, was that Fritz was on the program again. I was a host in a very sacred place in Fritz's life and in his home. Probably one of the most remarkable tapes ever made here at Holden was the one he did on the last days of his daughter. Now, he's shared some of this with you in the last couple of days. But he took me through his house and showed me where Sue spent her last days and the events associated with that. It was a worshipful experience, like the one we had another one with him yesterday. I've been privileged to have several of these very memorable events. One of them was coming down from Domke Lake on a platform just before you make the final descent at sunset one day, when four of us were privileged to that. And I'm grateful for that, and for these many times we've had together. And he'll have more to say about that later. But one of the things he talked about yesterday was the will of God. And I'd like to read you something about this. And here's a letter. I'm not going to tell you who wrote it until I finish. A letter to a niece. I condole with you. We have lost a most dear and valuable relation, but it is the will of God in nature that these mortal bodies be laid aside when the soul is to enter into real life. This is rather an embryo state, a preparation for living. A man is not completely born until he is dead. Why then should we grieve that a new child is born among the immortals, a new member added to their happy society? We are spirits. That bodies should be lent us while they afford us pleasure, assist us in acquiring knowledge or in doing good for our fellow creatures, is a kind of benevolent act of God. When they became unfit for these purposes and afford us pain instead of pleasure, instead of an aid, become an encumbrance and answer none of the intention for which they were given, it is equally kind and benevolent that a way is provided by which we can get rid of them. Death is that way. We ourselves, in some cases, prudently choose a partial death, a mangled, painful limb which cannot be restored. We willingly cut it off. He who plucks out a tooth parts at once with all pains and possibilities of pains and disease which it is liable to. Our friend and we are invited abroad on a party of pleasure which is to last forever. His chair was ready first, and he is gone before us. We could not conveniently all start together, and why should you? And I be grieved at this, since we are soon to follow and know where to find him. Adieu. Benjamin Franklin. Someone gave me this, and we received many things when Carn died. Now, I would like to read you something from Leslie Weatherhead on the will of God. Here is a mother wringing her hands and weeping in anguish because her baby is dead. Her minister stands by, longing to comfort her. But though his presence and prayers may offer consolation, he knows only too well that when the storm is raging, it is too late to talk about the anchor that should have been put down before the storm began. What I mean is that it is so important that we should try to think clearly before disaster falls upon us. If we do, then in spite of all our grief, we have a philosophy of life that steadies us, an anchor steadies a ship. If we do not, the storm is so furious that little can be done until it has abated. If only the minister could have injected into the mind of the woman his own belief about God. But that, alas, is impossible. In her anguish, this is what the woman said. I suppose it is the will of God. But if only the doctor had come in time, he could have saved my baby. You see the confusion of thought? If the doctor had come in time, would he have been able to outwit the will of God? The matter came to me most poignantly when I was in India. I was standing on the veranda of an Indian home darkened by bereavement. My Indian friend had lost his little son, the light of his eyes, in the cholera epidemic. At the far end of the veranda, his little daughter, the only remaining child, slept in a cot covered over with a mosquito net. We paced up and down, and I tried in my clumsy way to comfort and to console him. But he said, "Well, Padre, it was the will of God. That's all there is to it. It was the will of God." Fortunately, I knew him well enough to be able to reply without being misunderstood. And I said something like this: supposing someone crept up the steps onto the veranda tonight while you all slept and deliberately put a wad of cotton soaked in cholera germ culture over your little girl's mouth as she lay in that cot there on the veranda, what would you think about that? "My God," he said, "what would I think about that? Nobody would do such a damnable thing. If he attempted it and I caught him, I would kill him with as little compunction as I would a snake, and throw him over the veranda. What do you mean by suggesting such a thing?" "But John," I said quietly, "isn't that just what you've been accused God of doing when you said it was his will? Call your little boy's death the result of mass ignorance, call it mass folly, call it mass sin if you like. Call it bad drains or communal carelessness, but don't call it the will of God. Surely we cannot identify as the will of God something for which a man would be locked up in jail or put in criminal lunatic asylum." Those who want a text for this sermon will find it in the 18th chapter of St. Matthew's Gospel and the 14th verse. "It is not the will of your Father, which is in heaven, that one of these little ones should perish." Now, there might be some discussion on this in a few minutes. I almost went down the tubes with this. And I had done a lot of grief counseling as a principal administrator officer for a significant part of my life, because always somebody's dying. But I really didn't know how bad it was till it happened. I always wrote them wonderful letters of what to do when you lose big. And I told them to carry on. I didn't know how tough that was. You don't sleep. You don't feel like eating. I was involved in one meeting. I was heading for another Congress, an international Congress. I had some heavy responsibilities there. And when I got there, I could hardly walk a block. And I finally got a hold of myself, because you see what I was doing. I was nursing my own grief. And you can't recover from grief that way. You have to help others with their grief, and thereby help yourself, perhaps. I learned the importance of articulating one's grief. from Paul Tournier. The first time I met him was with our son, 1970. And I had a lot of questions for him, and he had fast answers for about everything. But then I related an event where the neighbor boy in Davis, California, firstborn, 27 months of age, drowned in the neighbor's pool. What do you tell those parents? And I related another incident of a person in Lutheran World Action whose child had leukemia at that time, at the age of 10. And Karl Mao wanted me to talk to this person. And I asked Paul Tournier, what do you tell them? And he said, he didn't answer right away. He says, well, you must allow them to articulate their grief. Well, the next year we saw Paul Tournier, Karin and Becky and my wife were along, and Karin talked to him in French. And 2 years ago, I saw him again. I was in Geneva and I rode ahead to him and said I'd like to see him, and I sent some material I'd written about Karin. Who, for those of you who don't know it, Karin, who spent a lot of time here, was a children's librarian in Tacoma, Washington, and always had a thing about Africa and always wanted to go there, and she finally got the opportunity to go with the World Brotherhood Exchange, or Lutheran World Ministries, and was a volunteer teacher in Cameroon, West Africa. And she died just before she was to come home after 2 years as a volunteer teacher. And when Paul Tournier, when I met him in town, he drove into town. He's 85 years old. And he touched me, as a good psychiatrist will, and with great compassion, told how he had remembered our daughter and was very impressed with her and the words about her, and it was a great source of comfort. And he said, at 85 he had 5 lectures that week. His wife died 8 years ago, and sometime before she died, she tripped over their dog and fell and injured herself and was taken to the hospital, and there were complications with her leg. So she was in the hospital, I think, for a couple of months. The day that she tripped over, the dog and left for the hospital, the dog had posterior paralysis. And the dog had posterior paralysis until the day she returned home again, and then it was fully recovered. Well, that serves to introduce one story about animals that I'm going to get to, and I'll get to another one in a minute, and for a fast discussion. Paul Tierney often recommends animals for people, and he said when he got old he was going to get another dog, which I thought very good. But he told me another thing that I asked him, as I have asked Fritz on occasion, and Al Rognes, who were also great help and lost big. Do you ever get over this? You ask hopefully, and of course you don't. And I assist you think of your wife often, and we had met her in 71. Every day. In fact, she's with me in about everything I do. And not as she was then, 8 years ago. But it's a continuing thing. I thought that very unusual. But he's a great source. And from him then I learned, and I've told other people that once, articulate your grief. You don't ask somebody, articulate your grief, because they'll probably start crying. But let them spontaneously do it. least that's what I found. Now, our daughter's attitude on death, I think, is expressed well in a letter we received. I've been thinking about life and death all day today. One of my students died yesterday after a very short, strange illness. He was one of the intelligent troublemakers, as opposed to the stupid troublemakers in his class last year. I was thinking today that I'm sure he's the student I had the most physical contact with last year. I was always pushing him back to his desk and holding him there. And we had verbal battles every day. Sit down, Mabala. Be quiet, Mabala. Where is your homework? Oh, why didn't you do it? Ad infinitum, ad repetium, ad nauseum. I've been feeling so sad ever since he died, and my cheeks are beginning to get chapped from the tears. The kids were subdued today, and the teachers who taught him last year, not one had a smile on his face all day. 14 years old is so young to die. I remember a theme he wrote for me last year about the last time he'd been to his village. I remember crying as I read it because they were so happy to see him. And then after the holiday was over, his father cried to see him go. And so did his mother and all his brothers and sisters. And Mabala cried too because he loved them and school was so far away from them. The theme was so simple and sensitive, so much at variance with his behavior in the classroom, that I couldn't help but ponder over it. Well, we're all crying again at this newest and longer separation. As I was walking home from school today, basking in the sunshine, I couldn't help crying out to God how terrible it was that Mabala would never feel the sunshine on his cheeks again. I should hold up higher for you. Can you see my lips? There's nothing like a death right in front of you, almost, to make you receptive to really listening. Maybe that's why sometimes life in America gets so trivial and banal, because we aren't close to death the way we are here. So we can ignore questions that concern the meaning of life and death. I've been thinking about staying another year, but I'm not sure now. Kids are always dying here, and I can't bear to go through it again. Almost every year, a student dies at college. Last year, it was a student I didn't know, so it didn't hit me. Now I know almost all of them and want to think of them all as having bright futures here on Earth. I don't want to mourn anymore. I'd rather go home where death is hidden away and the people who die are strangers in the newspapers. I came here to broaden my outlook. First, my kitten died. One morning, he's lively and supple and warm in my hands. And when I came home from school, I picked him up all cold and stiff and hard with ants eating his eyes. That was hard for me. I've had pets die before, but I've never held them in my arms and thrown them down the garbage hole. And now to have Mabala die. One of the tragedies of this is that I've tried to get a hold of Mabala's parents and tell them about Karn's love. And I've failed. Now, she had a great concern for animals, and that's what I want to now talk about. And animals do grieve. In fact, some of them die. And I'll start out with one of the lower creatures. When I was in aquatic and marine medicine 4 years ago at Woods Hole, I was the oldest person that's ever taken this course. It's a concentrated course of a month. There are mostly young people in there. But when you get old, knowing all the members of the class, because they all had their biographies, you see. And I probably knew least about the subject to be taught. But I went through the list and I picked my lab partner, who was Pat from Canada. She had taught the subject. So Pat was my lab partner. And she had recently, she was still in grief over the loss of her husband who was killed. And she did not share this with me, although I got to know her quite well. But she did share this with me. She met this fellow who had two male pet gerbils, which is a Mongolian rodent. She became rather fond of them, and she was very fond of him. In fact, in spite of the gerbils, she married him. And they were 4 and 6 years old at the time, as I recall. that is, the journals. And, and they'd let him out to play at night. And they enjoyed them very much. And they got, the gerbils sort of picked up on body language and probably words. They say, well, it's time to get the gerbils back in their cage. And the gerbils would hide. So they had to use a code. Well, after they'd been married about 3 years, one night, the gerbils were out, and the more curious one of the two, when she had opened the refrigerator door, had jumped up on the ledge. And she didn't see it, and she closed the door on it and killed it. And she, of course, was in great grief, but so was the other gerbil. In fact, the other gerbil refused feed and died in 2 days. A sheep I know who spent his entire life with a horse in a corral. And the horse was much older. And one day the horse died and they carried it off. And the sheep went into this cage and laid down and refused feed and died. You'll talk to veterinarians and they'll tell you about, especially dogs, they lose either a good friend, that's an animal, or a person. And some of them will go into grief. You'll have to intervene with probably forced nutrition. There are some very famous dogs. Hachi is probably the most famous one in Japan. There's a statue for it. It was melted down during the war and then built again. You always meet your sweetheart at this statue. It was belonged to a professor. And this dog would always accompany the professor to the railroad station and then meet him in the evening. And one day the professor didn't return because he died at the university. But for the next 10 and a half years, even though the family moved, the dog went every day to the railroad station, waiting for someone who would never return. Or if you go to Fort Benton, Montana, you'll see a statue for Old Shep. Old Shep was a shepherd's dog that served him well. The shepherd died. They hauled him into Fort Benton and put him on the railroad train. And of course, the dog couldn't accompany him, so he made his home underneath the decking of Fort Benton Railroad Station. And for the next 5 and a half years, met every train, checked every passenger that came into that station. And one winter night, either slipped on the snow or committed suicide. Anyway, he fell into the train and died. So they built a statue for him. And this is the first take-home lesson for you. I can give other examples of that. Pigs and gray lag geese and, of course, higher primates. It's awful to hear their call. When one of our white-handed gibbons in our cancer laboratory at the University of California lost her newborn, it almost made you cry to hear her mournful cries. And others have described this. It's terrible when you can't articulate it, you see. And so you hear this awful, awful vocalization. And a lot of people wouldn't believe it on pigs, and I could tell you a lot of stories about that. But the take-home lesson, first of all, here, is that you don't let an animal grieve like that. You put the shepherd dog back to work herding sheep with somebody else who will take good care of him. Or you find another professor for this dog to meet the train every day. We don't make heroes out of them, but put them back to work. And the other thing I want to say real fast about this, because it's time for Fritz, but a lot of people don't respect the value of animals to many people. To many people, they're the most important a creature in their life. There was a survey done by some good scientists who asked, if you have a companion animal, and over half, I guess, of the world, of the United States has, and 80% of the Australians, I think. But where is your animal in your family structure? Oh, it's a member of the family, 80% of them said. What member of the family? The child. With what I've already said, that has to hit you. Now, a friend of mine, Dr. Lynn Anderson, who's a captain, and he's looking at this whole bonding in the military now. And he did a study in Hawaii. And if you're a military person going to Hawaii, you've got to really love your dog, because it costs you $500 and 6 months in quarantine, you see, 6 months in quarantine. And so he did a survey of this military personnel, and he asked them where their animal fit into their family. I think it was 99% of them said it was a member of the family. So when they lose an animal, you never say to them, it's just an animal. If you ever do it, I'm out after you. I'm going to straighten you out. The other thing that I forbid people to say is, what if I would have done this? What if I would have closed that gate, or closed the door, or, you know, or got him a shot, or got her a shot, you know? That's self-flagellation, and it's just, you go down the tubes that way. So you don't allow that. And we have formed, informally in our town of Pullman, Terry, that trained the chief's dog. She's lost two dogs lately that have been with her all her life. And they were part of the family. She grieved. And we have the other names, so that when someone loses an animal, we put them in touch with her or a couple of other people that have lost recently, so they can listen to them articulate their grief. And it's very helpful to them. So I want you to be aware of this, that animals can die in grief, or they can become very sick. And this last point, and Fritz will probably expand on it, because he knows this better than I. But with any loss, whether it's divorce, or the chief losing her hearing, you, Barbara, losing your hearing, or death, you are at much higher risk initially for accident, disease, death. That's a proven fact. So be aware of that. And when I instruct our students, when you have that person in there for the euthanasia for the animal, you talk to them and be sure. I call it to their attention that, do you want us to take you home? See, can you drive your car? And you check on them and make them aware of this. And then announce that you're available to talk to them, to listen to them. That's what's more important. I have just two more minutes after a while.
Well, you can see why I was telling some of you a couple nights ago that if I have contributed anything to Oldham Village over these 23 years, the one thing of which I am most proud, and surely the most significant thing that I have done, is to get Leo up here. I have talked a bit about my daughter's death. Leo and I think, as close brothers, closer than brothers perhaps, think so much and feel so much in concert on these that his statement about beloved Karen will suffice. It was done so eloquently, and by Karen herself also. I'd like to take a little different tag. Grief became something of a topic for study for me when I met a man, Eric Lindemann. Eric Lindemann is a psychiatrist at Harvard and at Wellesley. A brilliant man, a Jew. Only a brilliant man, and perhaps most likely a Jew, could do what Eric Lindemann has done to open up an understanding of what is involved in grief. Eric Lindemann was going to bed one night in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and when he was over to pull down the shade, he noticed a big glow in the sky and realized that there was an enormous fire. Snapped on his radio and found them breaking into the radio saying, we interrupt this program to announce that there is a huge fire with probably large loss of life at the Coconut Grove nightclub. Some of you may remember this one. Biggest fire in United States history to that time. So Lindemann dressed and ran over to the Coconut Grove, which was not too far away from him. And he watched the people coming out, some of them with their clothes on fire, but already grieving for someone that may still be inside. Boyfriend worried about his girlfriend that he may have left inside. A husband worried about a wife. So he saw grief in that first shock of it and followed the people that were involved, the survivors, followed them for 25 years in the only good, deep, profound study that's ever been made of grief. So he had an understanding about what is involved in it and came up with some very interesting things. Some of them seem almost trivial. He, for instance, talked a bit about the sighs that we go through when we grieve, in acute grief. And said that the sigh should be understood, and when you hear the sigh, it should tell you something about what's going on in the grieving person. So sighing comes when you're bowed down with grief. There's something symbolic. The body expresses. You don't stand up like this to grieve. Yeah. You're bowed down with grief. That cramps your diaphragm, and you don't breathe so well. So Lindemann said, when the shortage of breath comes, you have to recover some way or another. So that's the sigh of grief. It is symbolic. It isn't simply a little physical reaction. It is a way also of expressing the agony of grief. Our bodies are used to communicate even to ourselves the agony of the grief. It talks about the same thing, that because of the sighing, the membranes, mucous linings dry out, and you better help your grieving friend in the acute stages by handing him a glass of water. Because there is some oxygen depletion, either because of this lower breathing rate, respiration rate, be sure that the windows are kept open, but stay away from the drafts, because the person is going to be perspiring. Little simple things that help so very, very much, and if we're concerned and know a little bit about these things, we can express our concern by doing some of those little helpful things. But Lindemann had that sensitivity that so many Jews have. The Jews never took man apart. Their anthropology is drawn out of the Old Testament revelation of what is man. So they've left the man together. And it's so easy for them to move into an awareness of this total human being. And the total being involved in this case in the grieving process. If you ever get a chance to pick up anything, there are any reprints still around. Lindemann wrote very, very little, but if you can find any of it, it may be helpful. all of us, not all of us, most of us in this room right now, are finding that the number of griefs with which we come in close contact is accelerating. We're at an age when more and more of our friends are leaving us, and our spouses. And it would be well for us to perhaps equip ourselves to be helpful. Lindemann suffered with all those people who suffered that night. Here he was a scientist, a great psychiatrist, and he studied for all of those years. And I think the main thing that he came out with was a little article in a journal called The Symptomatology and Management of Acute Grief. But it was his concern that came through those pages. While he was talking about these simple things, sometimes almost mechanical things that can be done to understand the grieving person and to help the grieving person, the message, the bottom line on that journal article was, I care, I suffer. I have seen him talk about people who couldn't express their grief after the Coconut Grove fire, couldn't express it, found no way, didn't feel free or safe to express their grief, who were sick people 25 years later. And I've seen Lindemann sit there with tears in his eyes talking about this poor person who was still grieving, but the grieving was locked up and couldn't then be relieved. Ulcerative colitis happens to be associated with grief, for instance. Leo mentioned that some of the illnesses that can creep up as a result of the shock of grief and our failure to adjust to the shock of grief. We're not well adapted to these shocks. But ulcerative colitis, for some reason or other, about 40% or something like that, occurs, new cases occur within 2 years after a grief, after a loss. And I'll just why it happens to be that particular one that is the most dramatic of these, nobody knows. But surely it can be anything. If you've had a grief, as Leo was saying, you should be alert to the possibility that even physical illnesses are apt to be coming. There's a great increase. But on the other side of that, so is great joy. A shock that we don't quite know how to handle. There is almost as much damage done, or as much illness following great joyous episodes as there is grief. Some of you have heard me talk about my rejection of the idea of thinking always in polar opposites, and if grief and joy are opposites, I'd like to bend them together a little bit more, because I would guess that some of us who have experienced acute grief and the terrible, ripping, tearing grief have also found that out of it somehow or another the joy came. Deep, profound, wondrous joy. And grief and joy shouldn't be far apart. The timing may not be exactly overlapping, but rooted in the grief, there comes maybe the deepest awareness of joy. It's a little bit as though Jesus were saying to us again in our own lives, and in this incarnation of Jesus, that he was approaching his hour of glory, when the hour of glory was the cross itself. There's a mystery here that somehow or another we ought to be getting a hold of. One of the most sharp experiences with grief I've had was when Bo died. Bo knew Holden well. Holden knew him well. Bo liked Holden 100%. Holden didn't like him 100%. nearly a nuisance. He raided the garbage dump and dragged things out that he shouldn't have. He went fishing with everybody that went up in the beaver ponds up here. And when they cast a fly out, and there are some people around here, you know, are neurotic fishermen. And to have a dog go splashing in to try to retrieve the fly was not their idea. The kind of tranquility that they thought should be associated with this delicate art. He ate sandwiches, but most of the people that went up to Heart Lake. So we had to have big notices posted to protect their food from animals, chipmunks and bull. They were most apt to get at it. Bull was a fisherman, which pleased me very much. When we left here, after staying here for a year, and moved down to Leavenworth, Bo missed the chipmunks because there were none not many to chase, but he took up a new hobby and he learned to fish. I remember the first time I discovered this, I was up on the roof nailing shakes onto the roof and looked down towards the river, and here was Bo standing on a rock. Now, another German short hair pointer, not the ones I've got now. But he was standing on a rock looking down into the water, and he stood there and stood there, and we laughed our heads off at this crazy dog that didn't know better than to stand there looking down in the water, but on point. Until we saw him put his head under the water and come up with a fish. And he gulped that down and went right back looking, and then pretty soon he's up on point. And we knew that there was another fish whose life was in danger. This dog fished almost every day in the decent weather. In the wintertime, he had better sense than to go down there and stand and freeze. I've never seen a dog fish, but he had learned this. And I remember where he learned. He learned it under a shallow dock where there was shallow water in a little lake in Illinois. And when the sunfish came in to spawn, he happened to be there one day. And he had learned that these sunfish came in to spawn, and he would sneak around from the lakeside and come in, wading through the water, and trap some of these fish up there. And that's where he'd learned this thing in the first place. And then one day, Bo started to heave and retch, trying to vomit, and he couldn't. Obviously, you get the dog outside when that happens. And this went on for most of the day. Every once in a while, he'd go into these terrible spasms, trying to get rid of something that was in there. And then I was going to take him over to a veterinarian over in Wenatchee one day. When we got over there, I made a stop at a shopping mart first before we got him over to the vet, because he was still ill. And then I noticed that when I was taking him out to air him a bit, going to let him get back in the car, that he couldn't make it into the car. Then I noticed that his belly was distended. So we found a vet that was about a half a block away instead of the one we were going to across town. Took him in there and left him, and got a call back a little while later from the vet saying that he had torn his spleen loose in trying to get rid of a half a dozen steak bones that he couldn't handle. And they were themselves tearing, but he tried to get rid of these things, but in the violence of the retching, he had strangulated some vessels attached, torn the spleen loose, and that was where the bleeding was coming from. Well, they got him patched up and he got home, and 2 weeks later, I noticed that he wasn't feeling well. He wasn't retching, but he wasn't feeling well. But didn't pay too much attention to it. I made a trip out of town, was gone for about 6 hours, came back and couldn't find him. He usually stayed out on our front deck waiting for us when we were gone. Then I looked all over for him and called and got no response from him, and couldn't imagine this, because he was always there when we came back, always, never missed him. I went down to my dark room, which is separated, there's no stairway inside the house to this spot, which is a hideaway for me. And here outside the door of my dark room, I found Bo. Again, his belly was distended, and I was sure that he was bleeding again. And this time I decided that we were not going to take him into the hospital. So I picked him up and carried him, and he was almost too big to carry, and I must have hurt him. Took him in and put him right in the dark room itself. And he almost immediately crawled under the little knee hole thing under my enlarging table. And animals die with dignity, don't they? It's an interesting thing, the way they take this with such poise. He went in there and got by himself and curled up and did his suffering. And then I sat down on the floor alongside of him, and an hour went by and another hour went by sometime later while we were sitting there. He moved and he came crawling out, put his head up in my lap and expired. One of the most painful and one of the most beautiful experiences I've had, wrapped up in this incident, where a dog loved me enough to want me to die in my lap. And then to feel that you can grieve as much for an animal as you can for a human. I've had humans that were close to me that didn't cause any more pain on their departure than what Bo did when he left. Well, Bo had a kind of successor. My dog had a puppy, a German short hair, that grew up to be a nice female pointer. And one day he called me from Chicago and said, "Dad, I'm going to send Borghild out to you. Because Borghild is going to have a family now, and my one-room apartment in Chicago is no place for this." I agreed with him, but I wasn't exactly anxious to have at that particular stage. I've been without my dog now for a while. I didn't even want any intrusion or a successor to my dog. I should have had a successor right away, because Bo died 8 months before I had a heart attack. Maybe I should have had a dog.
But it brings up an important point. I just want to inject one thing here. And that is replacement, which you're getting at.
Sure.
And some people will accept an animal and are ready for it in a short time, but most of them, it's an insult to say, "Well, just go out and get another one," when they're in the middle of grief. I mean, it's terrible to suggest that, you see. Let them decide.
Of course. There must be their own timing. Now, I don't think I was aware that some time had to go by to let me resolve this, but now, looking back, I think I could have saved Medicare some money if I had had the pet, because that has pretty been well established also, that there are some changes that take place in the reduction of tension, change chemistry in your body when you're petting an animal. Well, but no one came. Borghild. And she was lonely and grieving for my son. She had been with him every day of her life. She was 2 years old. But she'd been with him. She slept on his bed every night, unless he was in our house when he came to visit and brought the dog along, and we didn't let him put the dog in the bed. But outside of that, the dog was always up for the bed. Then I took the dog to the vet, and the vet said, "Well, you're gonna have 3 puppies any day now." And I thought this was gonna be a long time yet. "Any day now, she's just about ready. I can feel the 3 heads in there." And on a Sunday morning, before that, I should say, well, this crazy dog went through all this kind of stuff. all these ritualistic things that animals do before they give birth. She was lonely. We didn't want her to have the babies in the middle of our living room floor, so I made a birthing box and put it down by this same dark room thing. But she was so lonely down there, she cried and cried, and here she was in grief over the separation from my son, and now she was going to give birth to these puppies. So I moved in with her. I put a cot down there, and she quieted down a bit when she had some company, and I could reach over and pet her, or she'd come around in the middle of the night and nuzzle up against me a bit, and I'd pet her, and then she'd go back and go to sleep again. And then as some of these things increased in their tempo, and I realized it was about time. She woke me up about every 20 minutes on a Saturday night with some of her whining, and some of her coming over to lick me, and then some of her turning around in circles and lying down. She was very uncomfortable. I got up in the morning and went upstairs to Gertrude, and I said, "I'm much too old to start sleeping with a bitch." And I felt that way. But the dog had to have somebody down there. I took Gertrude to church and dropped her off fast and hurried back. And she was obviously drawing near the time she was going to have some puppies. And then I reluctantly went to pick up Gertrude. She could have walked home that day, but I got her and brought her back. Went down right away to see Borgie and how she was doing. Borgie looks at me, wags her tail a little bit, and then walked around in a circle three times and dropped her first little puppy. And then all these magnificent things took place. But what I'm getting at is two of the puppies, the first one born and the last one born, Leo could tell me more about this one. The first one and the last one were never going to make it. Out of the 12 she had, not three.
I want the name of that veterinarian.
You better teach these guys better because, well, he was a graduate, recent graduate from Leo's school. Good man, but he can't count.
He didn't want to upset you.
It would have if he had told me we're going to have 12, but the first one and the last one were very bad shape, malnourished little rascals. And it was quite obvious to me that they weren't going to make it, but not to Gertrude. So she would sit there with these things in on a heating pad. We took the two puppies away, and she kept them upstairs and put them on a heating pad, got an eyedropper and some kind of stuff that the doctor said should be used, and she drowned them, practically. You know, they couldn't swallow. Horrible thing. She tried to get these little things to. When I took the puppies, the little puppies, away on the second day, away from Borghild, Borghild became agitated. She was having a ball with her family of all these rascals running around this birthing box. But I take these two and took them upstairs. And then she kept going to the door and whining and abandoning the other puppies. So finally I thought, maybe she should know where those puppies are. Took her upstairs, and she looked at the puppies, and she licked them, and she wagged her tail, and then she would go away. She was satisfied. We were taking care of her puppies. Every day she had to go up. She'd stand at the door and insist on coming in so she could go in and see the puppies. Well, it was only 2 days that the puppies lived, but every day for the week or 10 days afterwards, she made that trip up, and she ran right to where Gertrude had been sitting each day with these puppies, feeding them, and looked for them, and then cried, whined, went to the door. Somehow or another, this whole creation groans and travails together, even in grief. The dog's grief and my grief. When Susan died, it got somehow or another brought along to when Bo died and into that experience, and the grief all becomes one. In grieving for Bo, I found that it was coupled up with Sue. I thought so much about Sue when I was holding that dog down. You don't like to say this among people that don't know you very well, because they'd say, how can you be thinking and comparing your daughter and her death with the death of a dog? But among friends, perhaps it could be said without being terribly misunderstood. Next door to us, we've got a family that, or a man, an unmarried man, whose mother came over a year ago to live with him. She had a little poodle that she loved very much. They were absolutely inseparable. Anytime she came to our house to eat in the evening, as she often did, the little dog was right under her chair. And then when Helen became ill and had to go to the hospital, that little dog started to grieve, and you could see it. It was restless. It ran around looking for her, and then would get down and take all the postures of grief. Then we found that the hospital was wide open to letting the pet in. So every time we went to visit her in the hospital, Central Washington Hospital over in Wenatchee, we took the puppy over, or the dog over. And the dog soon started to know that he was going to see Helen. Once we got him out of the car over at the hospital, and he was just crazy squirming all over. We had to hang on to him, because we couldn't just let him go and run through the corridors. Take him into the room and dump him on her bed. And then you should see the love affair going on full speed. That dog licking her face and she cuddling it and holding it. Many times she wouldn't talk to us at all before. I mean, we go through 15 minutes of first silence, but when that puppy was there, then she was happy. It was the most loved thing. She didn't miss it when she had to move out of her house. That is, she had to close up her house after her husband died. That was a grief situation. We grieve greatly when we move away from some familiar things. Huh? That wasn't as bad as being separated from her dog. Fortunately, the hospital, through guys like Leo, and primarily through Leo, has got some sense, and they know what human values are involved in this human-animal bond. So they allowed the puppy to come in. Not all of those hospitals have progressed that far yet. But this one did. I would go over to take care of the dog when Jim, my neighbor, had to be away, and he was gone for some protracted period of time during this. That dog would not let me open the door and or take him out. He went to hide every time. And we'd been on very friendly terms. He'd always come running over and wag his tail and don't want to be petted, until Helen went into the hospital. And now in this grief, he absolutely wouldn't allow me to touch him, to come near him. He hid under the bed. And the only thing I could do is just let him be. The house was kind of a mess when Jim came back. But there, it would have been foolish to terrorize that dog anymore by sweeping under the bed because that little pooch was suffering way too much. As Leo was telling us the other night when he was talking about pigs, these animals contribute so much to us if we will just let them. Our lives could be so much richer because of it. Albert Schweitzer had this profound respect just for life that he wouldn't even swat an ant, you know. Every time he came out of his dining room at Lambert, he would bring a little cookie along and crumble it, put it on his desk to feed the ants, and they'd come running out right away. Schweitzer wrote a little book. It's got some corny title that you can hardly associate with it, but something like On the Edge of the Primeval Forest, or Living on the Edge of the Primeval Forest, or something. And it's kind of about Africa, but there's some essays on various topics in there, and one of them is the fellowship of those who bear the marks of pain. And this man, who respected life, whether in the ant or the human, so very much, wrote eloquently about about the fellowship of people who suffer. Leo is helping us to understand that the fellowship of those who bear the marks of pain is not limited by species, not limited to humans, for instance, but the fellowship includes the animals. Our fellowship, our relationship to their grief includes the animals. That particular little essay, by the way, changed my direction. I had been teaching at Luther Seminary for a number of years, and it had a little repair work on a hernia and managed to pick up a staphylococcus infection and was hospitalized for several months. And during that time, I was reading, happened to read this essay by Schweitzer, and his thesis there is, cannot be supported logically. It's just illogical. But he says that anybody who has suffered owes his life to the suffering ones. Anybody who has felt the loss of, you know, death of a loved one owes his life to those who have so suffered. Anyone who has been healed owes his life to a healing minister for those who have been afflicted. And he goes on through a whole bunch of categories like that. So I left Luther Seminary, went back down to the hospital, and spent the next 20 years there. Because this constituted a kind of a call to me. I had suffered, and I had been healed. I had grieved, and I had been comforted.